The UN says that humanity stands on the brink of catastrophic man-made climate change. But is it true?
Not a chance. But we do stand on the brink of catastrophic government policies that threaten to ruin the nation our forefathers built and defended against tyranny.
So what drives the climate scare, Jay?
Besides simple ignorance, the scare is driven by corporate greed and the desire of government to control all aspects of our lives, Tom.
Is this part of something more sinister?
Indeed it is. Whether it's climate change or a pandemic or socialism, it really means sacrificing your rights and accepting the tyranny of the fourth branch of government, the bureaucracy. It must be stopped.
This is The Other Side of the Story with Dr. Jay Lair and Tom Harris of the International Climate Science Coalition.
Our guest today is Dr. Charles Dinnerstein, a medical doctor with over 25 years' experience as a vascular surgeon. Yep. He is a fellow for both the American College of Surgeons and the Society for Vascular Surgery. He's also the medical director at the American Council on Science and Health, a nonprofit science and health education organization. In addition to his medical degree, Dr. Dinnerstein completed his MBA with distinction in the George Washington University Healthcare MBA program. So welcome to the show, Dr. Dinnerstein.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, this is exciting to have you on. I've been following your work with the American Council on Science and Health, I guess, from the very beginning of when you joined the organization. Could you tell us a little bit about the American Council on Science and Health and what your role for them is?
Okay. The organization itself has been around for well over 40 years at this point and was founded by Dr. Beth Whalen, who was an epidemiologist. She founded it in the late 70s when the discourse on science was probably a lot more courteous and was concerned about a lot of the fraudulent science and snake oil out there, and set up the organization to debunk science, or at least bad science. It's grown over the years, and I've been writing for them for the last 5-6 years. I started as a staff member and worked my way up to being the medical director, though that may be through default, if nothing else. And I think that at this point, our goal is again to debunk bad science, and I think to educate the general public and consumers on what is important to know. I think the catchphrase that we've been using is to talk about big fears that have really little risks associated with them. Though I would have to say that the last year and a half of COVID has been a big fear and a big risk. So it's been an interesting period of time for us all.
Yeah, well, I've been involved with the American Council on Science and Health pretty much from its beginning. Beth Whalen's husband, before she passed away, was a Princeton graduate who I knew, and she would often come to reunions with him, and we got to know each other. And I joined the organization early and am a great supporter of trying to undo the tremendous damage that is done by junk science today. And certainly it's affected medicine very greatly. Now, you wrote an article that really caught my attention, basically starting a debate as to whether obesity should officially be considered a disease and therefore be funded under insurance and get government support and things of that nature. And I have to say, the first time I read the article, I thought that was a bad idea. I've always thought of obese people as having no self-control and can't control their appetite, or lazy, don't exercise. After reading the article the third or fourth time, I realized I was really being unfair, and the problem is much bigger. But one of the things that led me to your position was your use of the word disease. You split it up into two syllables, dis-and-ease, which is more or less quantifies a disease as being not at ease. And I wondered, did you create that term? Is that something that's already been in the literature and I never noticed it?
I'd like to say it was me, but I can't say that that is 100% true. I read a book by a gentleman named Austin Kleon that writes about creativity and writing things. And the title of his book was Steal Like an Artist. And I'm pretty sure that that is how I acquired breaking up the word disease into two. But the reality is, when we talk about what is a disease, is there is no great answer to that. And a lot of people say it's the absence of wellness, but then that, of course, leaves you to the question of what do you mean by wellness? So disease, I thought, was a good way of talking about any of these things, because it's just an absence of feeling right, if nothing else.
Well, one of the things that concerns me most about actually stipulating it as a disease, and I suppose listing it in the medical register of diseases, that too many people will give up on the self-help aspect of solving their overweight problem and figure, oh, well, I just have a disease and I'll lean on my government and my insurance company to take care of me. So would you address that in some detail, Dr. Dinnerstein?
Okay, sure. So I think that the question of should we classify obesity as disease has been around for some time. It bubbles up every several years. And there seems to be two different camps when you look at this. And I'm going to leave out for a minute the whole complexity of what's going on physiologically, because that's a whole different question. But the group that wants to have it declared a disease has a series of financial concerns, because once you classify it as a disease in our health and billing system, then it has a code. And if it has a code, then it can be used in a diagnosis, so that it opens up the opportunity for physicians and other members of the healthcare system to treat that disease. If it's a disease, it also means that the insurance companies may or may not cover various treatments for it, though they already do, whether they're calling it a disease or not. On the other side is the group that's arguing that, you know, there's that big cultural component to it, and are concerned that we body shame people, and that people that are grossly overweight get hired into good positions less frequently, and that they are therefore a class. There's disparities in their treatment, if nothing else, and they both have valid arguments, but the difficulty is if you treat it as a disease so you can bring more money to it will not change the cultural perceptions of people that are overweight. And changing the cultural perceptions per se is not going to necessarily mean that you're going to get monies to cover treatment. I mean, obesity is both a physiologic process and a cultural process and a dietary process. They're all intertwined and entangled. You're never going to be able to say it's this or that. And I think that, you know, Jay, you're right. And I'm glad that when you experienced and reread the article, you had a different take on things, but you can see how the camps may become solidified in one direction or another. And they talk past one another rather than with one another.
Yeah. Dr. Dinnerstein, what do you think of this new movement under critical theories where they talk about fat studies and people are proud to be fat? I don't know. That doesn't sound very healthy to me.
Well, let's talk about fat as a cultural norm. You think about the paintings by Rubens. Those were not slender women. Mm-hmm. And at one time, being well-fed and sedentary was a status position. And so that image was the cultural meme that people would strive for. And that has changed over the years. You know, I think that the value of critical theory, per se, is that it gives you the opportunity to relook at things through a different lens. And not everything that it finds is necessarily going to be the case, but it gives you an interesting or different point of view to that. So for instance, there was a study that we talked about on the website a few months ago where they calculated how many days of good life or bad life you would gain or lose by eating a certain food. And they did that by looking at the nutrients and looking at studies to see how these nutrients prolonged or decreased people's lives. And it was a lot of what I would call math magic involved. But the lens of saying, will this food give me a better quality of life or will this food give me a worse quality of life was not an unreasonable way to look at things. Now, to tell you, perhaps you'd like to guess what was the bad boy food, the one that would take away most of your life.
Chocolate cake?
I would assume it's sugar and fat.
Ah, but you guys are all wrong. It's a hot dog. Thank you. Because of the red meat, they calculated that every hot dog you ate would take away about 33 good minutes of lifetime for you.
Wow.
So that's math magic. But as they wrote later on, if you ate a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, that gave you 32 good minutes.
I am so lucky. My default lunch is a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
So I just had that image of first eating the hot dog and then eating the peanut butter and jelly sandwich, which obviously is not going to make me any healthier eating both of them. But according to the calculations, I would, you know, be at least even Steven.
You can't slide.
But again, it's an interesting way to view things. I mean, if people, instead of looking at a nutritional label, you said, is this going to add to the quality of my life or not? Maybe they would make other decisions. So I don't have a problem when they have critical theory looking at our view of fat, because I think that heavily influences how we think about things. I think body shaming is a real thing. I think that there's studies that suggest and show that in hiring situations, people that are overweight are viewed as slovenly and as lacking willpower and control and this and that, and are less likely to get jobs.
Mm-hmm. Well, hasn't shaming smokers had a positive effect on reducing the number of people smoking, or am I totally wrong about that?
I think that it probably has, but I don't know how. Well, that's an interesting problem, because it gets at the willpower, because smokers have an addiction and fat people, maybe they have an addiction too. But one of the differences is that you have to eat. You don't have to smoke. So there's a little wiggle room in there when we talk about shaming. And I think that when it comes to smoking, that what you've seen is that they've gone to great lengths, not only to deliver the health message that it's bad for you, but to restrict where that activity can take place. And that's not the same with food. We have lots of places to eat. You don't find lots of places to smoke anymore. That's just not, you know, we restricted it in a different way. And interestingly enough, I just read the other day that in Japan, where there's a lot more smoking going on, they've just decided in the last few weeks to go to a smoke-free work environment, so that the smoke rooms that they had set up in every major corporate building are now being closed, so that people cannot smoke at work, nor can they smoke working remotely. I don't know how they're going to enforce that.
Well, your article on the debate as to whether obesity should be classified as a disease appears this week at AmericaOutloud.com. And Tom and I wrote a companion article to it titled something in the order, is obesity becoming one of the greatest health risks in all of society? And we uncovered some research, I think sponsored by the World Health Organization, that indicated that virtually all obese people had their lives shortened, and that the most extreme level of obesity could take 14 years off your life. Is that work you're familiar with?
I'm certainly familiar with that type of work, and I'm very familiar with the numbers that the World Health Organization has put out, but they're certainly within a reasonable possibility. And that's part of why you get into this medical wrangle about whether it's a disease per se, because obesity touches any number of vital systems. It clearly affects our heart and our arteries. It causes hypertension. It puts more strain on the heart, so it increases the likelihood of developing congestive heart failure. Obesity also stresses our metabolic system. You can see a lot more people with type 2 diabetes because of their weight than pretty much any other factor that we can look at. You see obesity causing osteoarthritis and the need for hip and knee replacements. And if you are seriously overweight and you have a knee problem and you become sedentary, that sedentary quality also feeds back to your general fitness. So in one sense, obesity touches on so many systems that it's hard to call it a specific disease.
Can I conclude that it's virtually impossible to be healthy and excessively overweight?
That's an interesting question, you know, and so I took a moment out of my day here to pull some interesting numbers up. So Tom Brady is 6'4" and weighs 225 pounds. According to our basal metabolic calculations, he's overweight. And he's a quarterback, so we're going to cut him some slack. A defensive tackle, any of the defensive linemen, are usually in the range of 6'3", 340 pounds. They have a BMI of 36, which puts them into the very obese. And it'd be very hard to argue that these guys are not pretty well physically fit. So physical fitness and obesity are related, but they're not the same things. And that's always a tough one to get around. And I mentioned the NFL guys because they're obviously the outliers in the group. And so being overweight is not necessarily good. But when I said that obesity, which is measured by BMI, touches many things, you can also be physically fit by other measures, by how fast you get up and walk around, what type of exercise you do. And so that's why you can find people that make the argument that you can be fat and fit. For example, you know, I like riding on my Peloton, and I can go a lot longer, faster, and harder on my Peloton than I can on my outside bike because I'm not schlepping myself along. So in that sense, I'm more fit than I maybe thought to be based on my weight alone.
Let's talk about the BMI for a moment. It's now used so commonly, and I think it's very weak. BMI stands for what?
Body mass index.
It's your weight in kilograms divided by your height in meters squared. So that would be divided by your height in meters twice. And it's said that if you're below 25 or between, I don't know, 18 and 25, you're you're just right. And if you're between 25 and 30, you're overweight, and above 30, you're obese. And because of what you just said, Chuck, about the players in the National Football League who are obviously fit and come out being obese, it's not really a good measure. I kind of hate it because it's in the metric system, and so it's hard for someone to calculate their own. They got to take out a conversion table on meters and kilograms, which we did actually in the article that Tom and I wrote. Tom supplied the conversion factors for people. But do you have any, I mean, it seems like it's a weak measure. It seems like the fact that there isn't a good definition of obesity. In the article Tom and I write, I likened it to the definition of pornography. There is no definition for it, but you know it when you see it. I think that's definitely pretty true about obesity. We see an obese person and we recognize they're obese. We might be wrong sometimes, but you have any thoughts of how medical profession could do better at this?
Well, you know, I think that the BMI is an easily performed screening tool and gives you a sense of where patients should be directed. It's also relatively easy way to categorize patients when you're doing research. But like any measure that we use in science and medical sciences, part of the same large grouping, the quality and precision of our measurements certainly change over time. And I think BMI is left over from a different era. But it remains a measure that's really accessible. For instance, you know, part of the distinction that we would make about those NFL guys is a lot of that body weight is muscle. It's not fat. A nuance to BMI would be to separate out and look at the amount of lean fat on an individual, which you can do using a special scale to do it. Mm-hmm. But that's not readily accessible to everybody. So it's easier to screen with BMI and categorize people in that way, because then we can kind of talk about apples and apples. Mm-hmm. So there'll be some oranges and some tangerines and some pineapples thrown in just because of the choice that we make.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that concerns me about the critical theory approach is that some people who are overweight, they actually now are claiming that they're proud to be big and they're proud to be, you know, very heavy and whatnot. And I understand that's the opposite of shaming, but surely it's unhealthy because they'll look on being obese as normal and therefore not try to lose weight.
You're right in that regard, but I don't know that, again, there's that cultural piece, and not everybody is going to lose weight. Some of this is a learned behavior. Some of this is based upon the food options that you have, that you've grown up with, or that you know. And so it's very tough to disentangle it and say, oh, no, you've been eating the wrong things for so long and you have to change. And especially since we can't, you know, especially since it's not really just what you eat. And it has something also to do with your overall lifestyle, how much you're exercising, how much you're sleeping. There's some interesting studies coming out now talking about how the microbiome, the bacterial universe that lives within our intestines is different in patients with obesity and without. Now, which came first, whether their microbiome switched because of their diet or they developed obesity because of their microbiome, I don't think we're going to be able to resolve. But there clearly are changes there, and there's more nuance to this than simply that they're overeating.
Mm-hmm. You know, Tom, I'd like to disagree, or not just add something to your comment, that there are people that are saying, gee, being overweight is good, and you're basically issued a concern that that would become an attitude that would catch on. I think that's very unlikely. I think the number or percentage of people that would be very overweight and be proud of it and not be the least bit concerned will never be large, because the just the normal looking down and shaming of obese people will overdo that. It's sort of like there used to be every so often articles about people who exercised too much. Now, I am sure there are people who exercise too much, but I have a feeling I can count them on the fingers of my hands and feet, my toes. It's a very small number. And I think the concern that people who will be proud of being overweight will be, you know, very, very small. But while I now pretty much agree that it would be a positive thing to make obesity a registered disease with a code, as Dr. Dinnerstein mentioned, I am concerned that it would dramatically diminish the effort of obese people to lose weight on their own. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, again, I think that obesity and body image become entangled with one another, as you can say by some people saying, you know, I'm proud of the way I look, and that's the end of the conversation. And other people will look and say, no, this person's obese. Here's an example of that entanglement. When they did some studies looking at married couples, where one of them was very overweight and lost a lot of that weight, they went up getting divorced. And the thought was, is that there was, like any other quote unquote addiction problem, an enabling going on. And once the weight was lost in one, that relationship broke down because there was nothing further to enable. So I think that everyone comes up with their own sense of their self, and certainly body image is part of it, because you get the looks or you don't get the looks, and you make your peace or you don't make your peace with that. I don't think that you can, I think you should try to be fit so you live a healthy life with a good quality. You know, one of those kind of things where you're great until you're 90, then you fall over.
Yeah.
Rather than you have this kind of dwindling course where you're developing constant disabilities over time. When you think of the people that are morbidly obese, their quality of life is severely limited. They don't get out of the house a lot. They can't make use of normal transportation we do. So they've really lost a lot in terms of the quality of their lives. Now, sometimes that happens kind of slowly, so you don't notice it. And then you look up and say, what the hell happened here? I'm just living in my room. Mm-hmm. But I think that that's part and parcel of the issue.
Well, that's a good place to take a break. So when we get back, I'd like to ask you about something a little gruesome, and that is bariatric surgery. I was reading about it last night and actually found it hard to read the whole section. So we'll be right back after the break.
You know, Healthy Cell is a terrific lineup of products. They have products that are pill-free, gel-pack vitamins. Looking for better sleep, focus, and energy? Check out Healthy Cell, the leading innovator in nutritional supplements for cell health. Healthy Cell has a product that helps REM sleep, helps you fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deeply, and wake up refreshed with Healthy Cell's REM sleep supplement. The only sleep supplement that's designed to support all stages of sleep. And boy, is it needed now during all the stress of the COVID-19 pandemic. So go to healthycell.com and use the code OUTLOUD, all capital letters, OUTLOUD, for a 20% off your first order of any product from Healthy Cell. I use them every day. I believe in them, and you should too. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Each of us is born with 30 trillion cells that make us. These cells determine how we feel, perform, sleep, focus, and how long we live. And to live our best life, all we have to do is feed our cells. But most food and supplements don't reach our cells, keeping us from reaching our full potential. Make every cell count with Healthy Cell. Founded with a mission to empower people to take control of their own health at the most fundamental level, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, world-renowned cell researcher and medical doctor, created supplements that work at the cellular level to boost immune health, sleep better, focus deeper, and stay younger longer. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of any product. And that's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Today, America stands at the crossroads of history. Our actions will determine the fate of our nation. Well, that journey starts here and starts now. We invite you to join us in making the ultimate difference. Subscribe to our podcast and newsletters. Turn notifications on and stay in the know. You'll find all that back at AmericaOutLoud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
So when we ended the last segment, we were talking about bariatric surgery, which is the proper term. So can you talk about what that is and the pros and cons of it, Dr. Dinnerstein?
Sure. So bariatric surgery was a side effect of an older operation. Back in the 30s and the 40s, there was a very high incidence of peptic ulcers. And the treatment, initial treatment for peptic ulcers was to stop the bleeding and to do a resection and remove portion of the stomach that the surgeons felt was making the excess acid causing the ulcers. So parenthetically, I'd like to point out that ulcers come from a bacteria that we didn't find that out until 1970. So there was a lot of people that had stomach surgery for no great reason back in the 30s and 40s. But one of the clear side effects of having a portion of your stomach removed was a significant weight loss. And in the setting of somebody that had an ulcer, a significant weight loss was a complication. The 70s, and with the rising tide of people being obese, an operation that dropped your weight by 30 or 40 pounds, now that bug was now a feature. And that began the whole era and development of bariatric surgery. So bariatric surgery basically, in one way or another, decreases the size of the stomach. And sometimes it reroutes it, sometimes it doesn't. We can kind of get into the gorier details, but basically it reduces the size of the stomach so that you feel full faster. So you just don't eat as much. Now, we can hook you back up in various ways that will also affect other metabolic qualities about you. But all of the bariatric operations basically cause you to feel fuller, quicker, because they reduce the capacity of the stomach to hold on to food. And they work extraordinarily well. And they have really supplanted any other management for people that are morbidly obese or obese. So morbid obesity is an old term, which again gets to that idea that obesity touches on a number of things, which is a weight at which you are having other complications, diabetes, heart problems, hypertension, knee and hip problems. In those patients, those are the first patients that have ever had bariatric surgery, and it dramatically reduced their weight, 100, 150 pounds off 300-pound people. It really brought them back into line with things. And one of the reasons that it's become so successful is not only because it's dropped weight, because it has reversed the effect of diabetes in a lot of these patients.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So it's actually shrinking your stomach. Is that now, what kind of a shrinkage would it be? Half the size or a quarter of the original stomach?
Yes, it's not really, you know, when we take it out, it's not so much shrinkage as cutting it out. So that's one way to do it. There are other ways of partitioning the stomach so it's not as large and leaving it in place or putting a ring on it or various things, but they basically reduce the capacity by about half. Now you can overeat it. You can get past it. You know, if you eat slowly after about 20 minutes, you kind of feel full, but if you eat a lot real quickly, you can overeat that capacity, but very few people do it because they're pretty well motivated at that point to have something done. If you're going to have an operation to do it. Now, people that have type 2 diabetes, so this is a diabetes that's a result of insulin resistance, which comes on because you just can't handle your metabolism, as compared to type 1 diabetes, which is felt to be an autoimmune disorder and involves destruction of the cells that make insulin. They will see remission rates of 60 to 90% with bariatric surgery. So you go from somebody that's on one or two medicines for diabetes or on insulin to having none.
Oh, wow.
That's a pretty dramatic change for somebody with diabetes. Well, diabetes itself is a big risk.
I have three people very close to me that have had the bariatric surgery. One is a very close friend. She happens to be a doctor. One is my niece, and one is my sister-in-law. Both my niece and my sister-in-law, who were morbidly obese, had the surgery, and it did not succeed. They were able to go right back to eating everything they did before and stayed morbidly obese. The friend who was it's a doctor, was totally successful. I think you just said the success ratio, great, but say it again. And what are the risks of that surgery?
Let's talk about it in two ways. Let's talk about the risk of the operation itself. The risk of the operation itself is less than 1%. That puts it in the range of open heart surgery in terms of risk. But that's not a horrible number. The complications are in the 5 to 10% range, and they resolve around the problem of two problems. First of all, there can be, if you rearrange the stomach in its relationship to the duodenum, and we needn't get into the details of that, there's the possibility of a leak from that rearrangement. And that's a complication that needs to be addressed. And then there's the complication of operating on somebody in that weight range, because they're more likely to develop blood clots and infections in the postoperative period, despite all the precautions we take. So this is an operation that comes with more in the way of complications than mortality, statement one. But the question really is something that we've gotten back to before. What's the mortality of being morbidly obese? And if you go with what you had said before about the World Health Organization saying that people with obesity lost anywhere from 6 to 10 years of their life, the data on bariatric surgery shows that you give them back 6 or 7 years.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So do you want to take a 1% chance of having a very bad experience in exchange for 6 more years? Most people are going to be interested in that kind of a trade. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that strikes me, though, is that if you're trying to feel full, can't you just change the kind of food you eat? For example, I find before bed, if I'm hungry, but I know I've eaten enough and I don't want to gain weight, that I eat rice cakes, and they really fill me up. They're only 50 calories per rice cake. I mean, is that something, like, why not do that?
Some people do that. I mean, there's any range of a number of approaches to regulating your weight. So what you're talking about is, let me eat some foods that are not calorie dense. You know, celery is not calorie dense. The rice cake is not calorie dense. So I'm going to eat something that's going to make me feel full, and I'll feel satiated and go on. And a lot of diets are predicated upon that. The Noom diet is predicated upon that. Other diets are predicated on starving you for X number of hours. Other diets are substituting proteins for carbohydrates, like the Atkins diet. I mean, there's any number of ways to try and modify your diet, but that does not work for as many people as narrowing their stomach, which takes a lot of variables out of the equation. In order to follow one of these dietary approaches, you have to have the right foods and a certain level of discipline and be willing to not have this or not have that. With bariatric surgery, if you find that it's worthwhile to have an operation, then you're more inclined to, you can eat whatever you want. You just can't eat as much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I will admit that rice cakes are not the most delectable selection. I'd far rather eat peanut butter and chocolate.
Right. And, you know, and if I was in that situation, I would look at the peanut butter and the rice cake and I would say, you know, I could just put a little bit on and then there I would be.
Yeah, exactly. You just get the flavor and you don't get all the calories.
And I would want some more of the calories. I have to be honest.
Yeah.
Chuck, when I was a youth, we always were told or thought of heavy people, obese people, as being jolly and good tempered. And as I grew up, I found that that was really ridiculous. And that when you looked under the surface, in my own experience, I saw those people, frankly, to be quite depressed. They may not have showed it overtly, but I saw depression. What is your opinion as to, let's say, you know, the percentage of obese people who are likely depressed, and the depression probably causes them to eat even more?
I think you're partially correct about that. Again, it's one of those entangled chicken or egg situations. When people have looked at the situation and looked at depression leading to obesity, so that idea of, you know, I feel miserable, let me go eat something, they found that about anywhere from 24% to 300% of people that they surveyed and looked at who were depressed developed obesity as a result of that. So there's certainly a range there, and there's certainly good reason to believe that being depressed will cause a certain group of us to find solace in eating. They also looked at people in terms of being overweight and then whether they subsequently developed depression. And that was a smaller group. There was about 12 or 15% of people that were overweight subsequently became depressed. And they were two groups that they could identify that were more likely to have that happen to them: women versus men and teens versus any of the other age groups. When we get back to this question of body shaming, it starts to become clearer that cultural component and how that feeds back into obesity and causing depression. Because if everything around you says that women have to look a certain way and you don't look that way, you're an outlier, there's a reason to feel uncomfortable, anxious, and therefore be depressed. And the same, you know, when you think about junior high and high school, you know, the only goal in there is if you're, you know, the nail sticking up is to beat you back down. So that it really should be no surprise that cultural aspect is in there.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was reading a paper that Jay and I referenced in our article called Projecting U.S. State Level Prevalence of Adult Obesity and Severe Obesity from the New England Journal of Medicine from December 2019. And they were saying this, and tell me if you think this is an exaggeration. They say the findings from our approach suggest with high predictive accuracy that by 2030, nearly one in two adults will have obesity. And they're saying one in four adults is projected to be severely obese by 2030. So is that reasonable? I mean, sometimes when you just take a linear forecast, it doesn't really make sense. But do you think it's that bad?
It's bad. It's clearly a very significant problem globally. You just need to take a trip to Disneyland and you'll see that we are a country of people that are way, way overweight. And again, we are increasingly sedentary. We increasingly have a lot of nutritional options that are very high calorie density for for what they are, and that are convenient, and that they're there.
My daughter's a vegan, and she says you almost never see fat vegans. Is that reasonable?
That's certainly not unreasonable, because it's tough to get that many calories on board as a vegan. You know, the vegetables are not as calorie dense as meat.
Mm-hmm. I was actually calculating the other day that for a typical medium-sized serving of French fries, you could have 12 rice cakes, and I don't know if I could consume 12 rice cakes. So yeah, obviously food choice makes a big difference.
Oh, absolutely. You know,
Chuck, is the American diet perhaps almost the worst diet in the world? Are we leading the way in obesity because our diet is so bad and we have so much fast food and families don't eat meals together?
There's any number of underlying dietary reasons in there. Some of it has to do with convenience. Some of it has to do with accessibility, cost. So it's easy to pin it on one thing or another, but it to my mind, it's really a confluence of things. And to be real honest, I think that we got off to the wrong track when we decided that we would no longer have, and this will just show how old I am at this point. We got rid of home ec in school. Mm-hmm. And there are no classes on how to eat. There's no classes on how to shop, you know, which are basic things that we need to learn how to do. When I was working out in Pennsylvania, one of the things the hospital did with patients with diabetes, with new onset diabetes, is that they would take them to the supermarket as a group and would walk down the aisles and say, what foods here do you like? Which foods do you buy? And say, okay, fine, here's the other option. And show them in the market the alternatives, because talking about it does not work. And we're not educated in school to really look at our food nutritionally.
It's interesting. Another New England Journal of Medicine article from August 2020 was called Individuals with Obesity and COVID-19, A Global Perspective on the Epidemiology and Biological Relationships. And here's a quote. Maybe you can tell me if this is exaggerated again or if it's reasonable. Individuals with obesity are linked with large significant increases in morbidity and mortality from COVID-19. There are many mechanisms that jointly explain this impact. A major concern is that the vaccines will be less effective for the individuals with obesity. Do you think that there is a connection between morbidity and mortality from COVID-19 with obesity?
Yes, but that's because you're using obesity as the marker for all the fellow travelers. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean, again, obesity touches your heart, it touches your kidneys, it touches your metabolism. So people that, we know that people with diabetes, people with significant heart disease fare less well with a significant infection from COVID. These people are, whether we recognize it or not, more frail than they appear. And so you can use the word obesity to describe it, but when you, if you were to subtract that out, you would see that underneath that, the people that were obese were also the people that had high blood pressure, that had diabetes, that had heart disease, kidney problems, all of which make COVID-19 worse. I don't think that there's been any data to suggest that these patients fare differently than other patients in terms of being vaccinated. I don't think there's any evidence that they have more side effects or that it's any less effective.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chuck, could you make a kind of sum up your own opinion one way or the other with regard to obesity being added to the list of diseases that insurance and government support should just regularly take care of? Where do you land on this debate?
I'm going to go with the last thing that I had written in that article. So let me just quote it since it's convenient. To the extent that payment for treatment might improve outcomes, the answer is yes, we should consider obesity a chronic medical problem. But if the goal is to reduce the stigma, then shifting victimization from the current cultural norms to it's the fault of ourselves and our genes is not a solution to the problem. We do ourselves a disservice if we say that it has to be this or that. It's both. We can't be so reductionist about any of these diseases, especially a disease that's related to eating, because we all eat. And there's a whole cultural piece that comes with eating. Come from a Jewish background, so they're always feedings.
Is the debate going on now within the government and the insurance industry, and in what direction does it look like it's going, in your opinion?
I think that they're not going to declare obesity as an ICD-10 disease. I think they're going to let it continue as is, because they can always modify the structures they have. When you get into coding, and that's a whole different world of things, you can have diabetes with obesity and code things that way. So I don't think there's any advantage to doing that. And I think that at this point, most of the insurance companies are already covering surgical care. 20 years ago, you really had to jump through hoops. You had to be on a strict diet. You had to show a 20 or 30 pound weight loss over 6 months before the insurance companies would even consider it. But that's changed significantly. And while they do want to assure that you're a good candidate for surgery, they've lowered the criteria to do it, because it in the end, it cuts our healthcare costs. People mm-hmm. that undergo bariatric surgery and lose 20, 30, 40% of their body weight are healthier, and they don't come bouncing back into the hospital with diabetes, hypertension, heart disease.
Mm-hmm. Last night, I was looking at various data about the number of deaths by risk factors on a site called Our World in Data. And it actually had obesity as the fifth leading cause of death in the world. And I was interested to see that there's a speculation that it may one day be the greatest cause of premature death. Are we really going that far, or do you think it's exaggerated again?
I think that we've developed nutritional systems that our million-year-old metabolism does not know what to do with. Mm. And we need to figure a way out of that particular bind. And I'm not sure that there's any one good answer mm-hmm. to how we get there. But again, in the same way that we ended home economics, we really cut out physical education. So is it a surprise that we're sedentary? If you don't learn how to incorporate exercise into your day when you're young, how can we expect all of a sudden when you're 25 or 30 to the magic light come on and say, oh, I got to start doing something?
Yeah. Well, as you were saying earlier, if it has such a big impact on depression, then surely this is, in some cases, an alternative to medication, exercise.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I think there's some good evidence to suggest that that is useful.
Mm-hmm. You know, Professor Philip James, chairman of the World Health Organization's International Obesity Task Force, he said that at least 300 million adults worldwide are extremely obese, while over a billion are overweight. Again, is that an exaggeration, or do you think again?
You know, when we're working with BMI, so what do you mean by that? You know, the numbers, you can play with the numbers in any way you want. If I lower the BMI down, I can make more fat people. I can make less fat people on a statistical basis just by moving that marker. But it's clear that on a global scale, there are more and more of us that are more sedentary and absorbing more calories than we necessarily need.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point to end off with. You know, it was a very interesting interview, that's for sure, Dr. Dinnerstein.
Well, thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was great. And hopefully we'll get people out exercising more and watching what they're eating. But that was really great. Okay, so this is Tom Harris and Dr. Jay Lear with our guest, Dr. Dinnerstein, signing out from the other side of the story.